So this is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance. I have the pleasure today of being with Helen and Newton Harrison, who are in California right now. And we're going to discuss art and climate change in preparation for the COP21 meetings in Paris at the end of November. So, Newton, maybe you could introduce yourself and Helen, and then we'll pick up from there.
Okay. My name is Newton Harrison. Sitting with me is my long-term companion of 60 years and co-author of all our work for the last 40 years, 45 years, 46 years maybe. And Helen, if you want to introduce yourself, go ahead. We're artists. Helen comes out of literature more. I come out of, I was trained classically as a figure sculptor. But my comfort level is in the sciences, particularly the biological sciences. But more recently, I've had to start re-understanding the laws of conservation of energy, particularly the first three laws, which are why we think the Holocene is okay, but moving it to this other name doesn't work.
Maybe before you get into that, I can just give the context. One of the things you sent me to read in preparation for this discussion is the final chapter of your Force Majeure book. And in it, you have this sentence, reflecting on these matters, we disagree with the scientific description of this new age as a movement from the Holocene to the Anthropocene. So I wanted that to be the takeoff point for our discussion. So maybe you can explain the background to that statement.
Okay. In 1973, Helen shows up with a couple of books, one making the argument that we're in an interglacial, it's going to get colder. The other makes an argument we're in an interglacial, it's going to get warmer. 5 or 6 years later, we write a piece and make a world map. It shows the oceans rise, and we actually conclude that there's no way around increased carbon and ocean rise. And the question is, can we help each other? Well, I mean, when my house goes under and your drought wrecks your food supply. And 35 years later, we come up with an answer. No. We're not going to help each other very much. And why is that? And that's the core reason behind why we think the Anthropocene, why that doesn't work. Okay? It's that we've not just shifted from one phase to another by some climatological situation where, say, we're closer to the sun. Okay? What we've gone and done is we've raised the carbon in the atmosphere, that's human behavior, from, what was it, a little under 300 at the Industrial Revolution, to now it's over 400, and heading to 6 and much higher, say, our climatologists. Well, that's human. That's not the sun getting closer. That's not a normal progression or cycle. And Holocene and Anthropocene assume or have embedded in them the implication of normal cycle.
Yeah, so let me just jump in on that. So indeed, you know, as you point out, if you look at the geological record over the last 500 million years, we do know that there are a number of these cyclical factors that have affected human climate, including the distance from the sun. But even the movement of the sun through the galaxy and through the galactic plane and so on, and as you say, those cycles are kind of inevitable, periodic, predictable cycles to some extent. Now that doesn't mean the climate always reacts in very predictable ways because it's a chaotic system and so on. But as you say, the you know what's going on at the moment is a totally new phenomenon.
Yes. Exactly. And to follow up with your climate argument, like The Eemian, for instance, of like 115, 120,000 years ago, had very similar weather to what we have now, and then probably similar species that lived in a 10-degree warmer or 8-degree warmer Fahrenheit, that is, cycle. But to our complete astonishment, the CO2 in the air was under 300.
Yep.
So that we're one would have expected it to be 400 or 500 with 10 feet more ocean or 12 feet, 16 feet more ocean. So this predictability stuff is a little iffy. But what we've added is a new dimension to it. And that's why the new dimension has a manifestation. And the manifestation is a wave front of heat touching all surfaces, a wave front of water rising against all surfaces that face the ocean. Now, these two things happening simultaneously and more rapidly than appear to be, although Hansen may be wrong, more rapidly than any other, than in the historic means, suggests that a giant force is at work. We call it the force majeure. We snitch it from a legal term and revise it and apply it to the laws of conservation of energy.
The other thing about it I'd inject into that this discussion is a lot of the cycles that we're talking about happen on relatively long timescales.
Yes.
And so if you look at the level of the Mediterranean Ocean, for instance, it has gone up and down over the last 100,000 years. And what happened was when it started rising, people moved.
Exactly.
But it was happening slowly enough that, in fact, you know, people moved over 50 years, 500 years to higher ground. As you probably know, there are caves below the surface of the current Mediterranean where they find human remains and places where people live. Now, of course, what's happening now is we're looking at changes that happen within one human generation. And, you know, the only analogy I can make is meteor strikes, right? I mean, those are very short events. But in general, these climate change variations have been ones where we've been able to evolve our human societies slowly, right? So the Anasazi moved.
Some of that species themselves have been able to move.
Yes.
Whole ecosystems moved. Landscapes moved. If you take a look at what we've done now, we have 11 million square miles of farmland, mostly factory farmland. Well, what does that mean? That means we've removed the seed stock from all the arable land. How will species move? How will landscapes move? And so that's another reason why we say a force majeure is at work. We've set many, many, many systems under stress. And why have we done that?
One of the things that I think, you know, is interesting is that, okay, so, you know, we can talk at length about all these theoretical ideas, and I want to get back to the three laws of energy conservation if we have time. But you've been working in recent years with environmental scientists and ecologists in a very specific national park area in California, and you're actually looking in detail at this question of plant migration. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, okay. Helen wants to chime in on something?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Helen.
I want to chime in on the fact that a very famous German anthropologist talked about, and that was that as we walk down the street thinking of seeing the natural landscape do there, we forget that a number of thousands of years ago, when somebody came over on elephants over the boom, 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 he had it.
What Helen's talking about is a very well-known guy who won the German Ecology Prize named Bartlott, and he was telling us about how Hannibal's elephants brought over a whole bunch of species that are now a third of the species in the German meadows. So that fear of moving species around is absurd. A fear of moving stupidly is not absurd at all.
Just for the anecdote, I know the Hannibal story very, very well, because as he was moving on his way to Italy, he actually camped in Marseille, where I was living.
Wow.
And the university is now on the hilltop where he camped.
Amazing. Well, we owe him a debt.
Owe him a debt.
Yes, he solved the problem intellectually for us. Yes.
Anyway, so if we have about 5 minutes left. If you want to just tell us about the work you're doing right now and I forget the name of the park you're working in.
Okay, we're working in the 9,000-acre nature reserve. That's a research station for UC Berkeley. We have our force majeure is a group that's a nonprofit, and it's associated with the UC Santa Cruz where we are. So it's all part of one system. At there, we decided to do something. We decided to interrogate a watershed. Can you ask a watershed questions? For instance, can you ask it the question, did you survive a million years? If you did, then do you have genetic material remaining in you that did well when it was 10 degrees warmer and when the rain was heavy and intermittent and all the glaciers were gone? And if the answer is yes, can we find that? And can we propagate them? And therefore, can we propagate their future in the now? And that's what this question is about. That's what this work is about. And on top of that, if we can we propagate a species that could move upward as ecosystems fade back from global warming stress? And I don't like the word climate change. The globe is warming, and that is what the climate's doing. So why don't we say climate warming instead of climate changing?
So do you see this as basically a sort of a symbolic line of
questioning? The symbolic stuff.
Well, can you actually imagine mobilizing human society to make sure that our ecology adapts quickly enough to adapt to the new climatic conditions?
Let me put it this way. If no, we go back to being small tribes who've been clever enough to continue. If yes, the larger culture can continue. Can't know which, but why should we even worry about it? What we're putting on the ground is methodologies and information that will let decisions be made.
I totally agree with you. And indeed, you know, given that we're dealing with an unprecedented condition, which I think your force majeure argument makes, we're looking at unprecedented ways of organizing human societies.
That's correct. We get to that. We rewrote the end a little bit before you got it. and we asked if we couldn't interrogate the world ocean. I think we'll find that the answer is yes and no. And that would require a world ocean government set that had control over all others and could enforce it. If yes, we have a working ocean. If no, we don't.
Okay, very good. We're going to have to wrap this up, unfortunately. And so, anyway, I'll make sure that our listeners have the URLs to your current projects and so on. And obviously, I'm looking forward to seeing the book when it's published.
There's a funny story attached to that. One last thing. At Sage Head, we propagated at our arboretum 12,700 plants.
Uh-huh.
We put them on at five different altitudes at 500 feet apart and in three patches at each 500-foot level. So we have ways of we'll be able to find out who's toughest. Instead of searching for helping species in trouble, We're finding the strongest species who can continue.
Excellent. Well, unfortunately, this is a much more benign experiment than what Europe is conducting right now with the refugees from the Middle East. Anyway, so we'll stop there. Thank you, Helen and Newton.